Welcome to the Local Spotlight Show here at WJBM Studios in Jerseyville, Illinois, the voice of the Tri-Counties. I am Chris Lorton. I am your host, and I am very pleased and proud. My guest today, Kevin McCarthy. Welcome, Kevin.
Hey, Chris. Good to be back home.
Oh, yeah. Kevin McCarthy, KMOX broadcaster for 15 years,
yeah.
1981 to 1996. Graduated from Southwestern, just down the road.
1965.
Yes.
Yep.
And had roots here in Kane. Third cousin to my wife, Brenda.
Yeah. Yeah, we're family now.
Yeah. You've basically traveled all over broadcasting, 54 different countries, I think you told me.
Yeah, 44.
Like 44. Yeah. You broadcasted the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Yeah.
And you actually tried to get a job here at WJBM in 1969?
Yep. Right 69. After I got out of the Army in October.
Okay.
And it was kind of interesting. And I'd always wanted to be in radio, and some things in my childhood had led me to that. But I came over here and asked for a job. And I said, well, have you got a first-class engineer's license? I said, I have no idea what that is, so I guess I don't. And back then, when it was tube radios, transmitters, and so on, because signals would drift and so on, you had to have, by FCC rules, a first-class engineer on site all the time.
Oh.
And, of course,
small. Oh, because if you were the only one in the station.
Yeah.
You had to be able to do it. That's why.
Yeah. You know, smaller stations couldn't afford a full-time engineer, which is understandable.
Oh, yeah.
And so the air talent ran their own board and had to be an engineer.
I wondered. I didn't know why you had to have this license,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, the FCC was much more restrictive then than it is now. So they told me I could go to Louisville and take a school there for about 6 or 8 weeks. It would only cost $5,000. And I went,
yeah, which is a lot of money.
Yeah, I barely.
Now and back then.
Oh, yeah, a lot of money back then. And I was waiting on my first unemployment check so I could go out to Bush's and have a few beers here in Jerseyville. So I had to pass on that. Yeah. Or they passed on me.
Well, I'm sorry that you got turned down by WJBM. But
yeah.
But
yeah.
If you would have came in, if I was here, I would have made a way. I would have got you hired.
Somehow. Well, that would work. I'm still available.
Well, okay. All right. We got Craig. He's going on vacation here in the end of July. So we'll keep that in the back of our hat. So what was your first full-time radio job? Or what happened? How did you get into radio?
Oh, I guess my first radio bug, I was about 9 years old, and the Salk vaccine had just come out, and it was the injection, not the pill. And my mom and I were waiting for my dad to go out to dinner at the Stratford Hotel in Alton, and WOKZ had their studios at that time up on the mezzanine. So yeah. We went up and looked through the window, and the guy invited us in. You know, yeah. He said, well, what are you doing? I said, well, I got my polio shot today. It hurt a little bit, but it's better than getting polio. And so I had the bug right then.
Oh, shoot.
And then throughout high school, I had a band that worked with KXOK. And being in the radio station all the time and watching Johnny Rabbit work and so on, I further interested me. And when I was managing a household finance office, which is where I went to work after I didn't get hired here.
Okay.
I was in Waterloo, Iowa, and there was a little station, daytime station there. It was just a screaming rock and roll station.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They called themselves WLS's little brother.
Okay.
When they'd sign off, they'd say, now you can go up the dial a couple of notches and listen to Big Brother WLS. And a new guy, Jim Mudd, bought the station, and the jocks were sitting in a bar one night, and I was there with my barber, who had his shop right across the hall from my HFC office in the shopping center. And they were all chipping their teeth. They're going to join a union. They didn't like that guy, or they're all going to quit. And I said, you know, I should do that. And my barber says, sure. I said, put some money on the table, pal. So $5 bet. And Monday morning, I walked into the station there. It was Waterloo Cedar Falls, WCFI, Cedar Falls, Iowa, and said, I understand you might be in need of at least a part-time DJ, and I'd like to do that.
Now, at that time, you didn't have to have a license.
Well, you did, but they had loosened it. You could get what was called a third-class engineer's license with a broadcast endorsement. You still had to take a little test.
Okay.
But your chief engineer signed off on it before you took the test, so you could go on the air right then.
Okay.
And that's what I did. And I
said, he liked your voice.
Well, I guess, and I told him I had a band and knew my music, and I had a killer stereo, and knobs and dials didn't scare me. So he goes, come on, big boy. It was an old house, so it was kind of cool. Yeah. The newsroom was pretty much the bathroom.
Okay.
And went into the studio. He says, here, that turns it on, that turns it off, that turns it up, that turns it down. Go nuts. And I did.
I'll be darned. So,
as I would transfer around with, I worked at two stations there on the weekends. And got
kept your regular job.
Yeah, and got transferred with it to Springfield, Illinois, and did the same thing with two stations there, WMAY and WCVS, and came to St. Louis and got here on a Wednesday, and Saturday I was on the air at KIRL.
Curl.
That was a rocker at
the
time.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I worked at KSLQ, KADI, KS94, and KMOX called and said, we want you to work on the FM station. So I went down and talked to Bob Hyland.
Now, the FM station at KMOX, it was music?
It was easy listening, kind of elevator music, but they knew they were
doing rock and roll pretty heavy.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they knew they were going to change, I guess, at the time.
They were looking for somebody like you.
Yeah, and pretty much a whole new staff. There was a time there where they did disco for about 6 months and knew that didn't work.
In the 70s.
Yep. And they offered me the night shift and basically the same salary I had at Household Finance.
Yeah.
And I was doing the hiring and training for the Midwest region and had a company car and expense account, and I had to turn them down. Well, for one reason, I didn't have a car that was drivable of my own.
Okay.
And went home, kicked myself in the tail, and said, I'm not going to get caught with my pants down like that again. Bought a car. And about a month and a half later, they called back and said, okay, we'll give you the midday shift and pretty much double the salary.
Wow.
That's pretty much what I said. That's hard to beat. Other than I looked Mr. Hyland in the eye and I said, you know, I've been in this long enough to know that Air Talent's success is judged by the size of their U-Haul. So, you know, if this is another 12 or 18 month deal, I'm still not interested. I'm leaving a career less than 2 years shy of full retirement benefit vesting.
I know. What'd your wife say? What'd she say? She was with you?
Yeah. Yeah, sure was.
Okay.
And I said, if this is a career, I'm in. He stood up and shook my hand.
Yeah.
I never had a contract there for 15 years.
I'll be darned.
And it was a good ride.
Yeah. Now, what was it like? Was that CBS?
Yes. Oh, yeah. CBS owned and operated station.
Okay. What was it like there for, you know, what were some memorable experiences working there?
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, you know, that being my first full-time job, I ended up going to school working with Jack Buck, Bob Hardy, Art Fleming, Jack Carney, a young, eloquent kid by the name of Bob Costas. You know, I was just, that was pretty rarefied air.
Yeah, it was.
And
you had to have all those guys around you, all that talent.
Yeah. Yeah. Jim White, the big bumper. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was just amazing. I mean, people, for our viewers and listeners, a job at KMOX at that time was the pinnacle of broadcasting.
And you just walked right into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Luck of the Irish.
Yeah.
And a lot of BS.
Hey, if you're just joining us, I have Kevin McCarthy with me, longtime broadcaster, KMOX, and broadcasted all over the world. Go ahead, Kevin. Tell me more.
Oh, well, again, that KMOX gig was incredible. And with that, I got to work both sides of the gate, if you will, the AM and the FM. The first night on the AM, was the 4th of July VP fair.
Yeah.
And Hyland said, I want you to work like from, I got off the FM at 3. He said, from like 3 till 7.
3 in the afternoon.
Yeah. I said, oh, sure, glad to.
Yeah.
And he said, we'll have everything set up for you. The producer will have patriotic music and guests lined up. Won't be any different than other than you're easy. Not playing music. Yeah. Yeah, easy deal. So I had just interviewed the Harrier pilot, you know, the jump jet.
Yeah.
That's an amazing piece of machinery.
Jump jet.
Yeah.
What's a jump jet?
The vertical takeoff.
Oh, okay.
And
all right. Yeah.
Yeah, that thing set down on the river, and you heard this huge noise, and all of a sudden, there it was looking at you right through the legs of the arch, and you knew that if anybody else saw that out in the field, they were going to have a bad day.
You know. Now, what year was this?
That would have been 83.
Okay.
Yeah. And I brought the Harrier pilot down and did
an 10 or 15 minute interview
with him. And I said, who's next? And they went, producer looked at me and said, we don't have anybody.
Yeah.
I said, okay, well, play some of the patriotic music till we can get organized. I don't have any.
Gosh.
And I'm watching my life pass before me, okay? We had Mary Phelan and Art Fleming down on the arch grounds with a wireless microphone, so I threw it to them, and it didn't work.
Oh, no.
And this was the story of what went on, you know. I'm doing a song and dance, trying to get them on the air. And
this is on KMOX.
Yes.
The biggest radio station.
50,000-watt clear channel.
In the country.
That can be heard all over the U.S., clear down to Australia and Europe, you know.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm like, I don't know. But I have to tell you, just being there that first time and saying KMOX.
Yeah.
You know, your whole body just kind of, ooh, that's cool. Scared to death. And we did some commercials, and the producer ran up to the music library and got some music and so on. Well, I was supposed to be off the air at 7 or 8 o'clock. Charlie Manese was supposed to come in, and this was during the fireworks show. They had all of downtown, the traffic and everything. He couldn't get to the station until almost midnight.
Oh, boy.
So I signed off at about 11:30 when he got there and drove home and said, well, I'm going to be looking for a job. There was never a word said.
Well, it wasn't your fault, really.
No, but that doesn't matter when you've got a 50,000-watt radio station with nothing on it.
Yeah.
And, yes. And it went from there. Ended up doing, another kind of fun one, an amazing story was, I was doing radio work in Europe. I had done some music and media conference in Cannes, France, which is, you know, like the film festival. Same people, it's just for music and media. And also the Montreux Rock Festival, and made friends with a guy who had retired from the Air Force and was working for radio in the American sector, the last part of Armed Forces Radio Network in Berlin. And I had just sat down upstairs at the FM to go on the air at 3 o'clock. I was doing an afternoon drive then. And he called and said, get over here. The wall is coming down.
The Berlin Wall.
Berlin Wall.
Iron Curtain.
Yes.
And it's coming down.
Yeah. I said, Rick, I don't know what you're smoking, but it must be good. Send me some. He said, no, it's either World War III or the wall's coming down. Grab a tape recorder and get over here. So I called Hyland and said, the wall's coming down.
Your boss.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it takes some doing to pick up the phone and dial him instead of vice versa. And he said, how accurate are your sources? I said, at least 75 or 80%. Well, go. But I'm supposed to just go. My ex-wife worked for TWA. So I said, meet me at the airport, and jumped a plane and was there on Saturday morning, their time.
Yeah.
The only ID I had was my door card for KMOX.
The only ID? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, you know, no press ID or anything, you know. And I got down to the stage, the podium, right in front of the
So paint the picture what was going on then prior to that.
Oh, total chaos.
Okay, so the wall was still intact. They hadn't started, or they hadn't opened the gates
yet.
That was
Saturday night. But I got down to the stage, and it was a big step up, just about as high as this table. And I saw Dan Rather there, and I knew that he and Hyland were friends.
Uh-huh.
And I said, "Hey, Dan, Bob Hyland sent me." He reached down, grabbed my hand, pulled me up on the stage, and I was standing there next to him and Billy Brandt and all the guys from the various TV networks. Saturday night, it all happened. And about 10:30, 11 o'clock, and I mean, you couldn't, it was gridlocked, everything.
Yeah.
And the you could hear diesel engines starting up on the other side of the wall.
Yeah.
And you didn't know if it was tanks or bulldozers. And it was bulldozers.
Yeah.
And it went down, and all of the East Germans who came over were, by German law, given what they call Wandergeld, or walking money. About 50 bucks, and they started lining up at the banks, and it was cold. I mean, really cold. And we tried to get them to go down into the subway stations to stay warm. We gave out line tickets like at a concert. They had no idea what that was. So people started coming out of the buildings and apartment complexes and homes with hot chocolate and coffee and blankets and jackets, and it was like the 4th of July and New Year's Eve and Christmas and your birthday and everything else. It was just amazing.
And both sides were so happy to be able to get together.
Yeah, yeah. Later, Bob Hardy and I went back as part of a East German tour, Berlin, Prague, Budapest, Warsaw, and Moscow. And that's where I got hijacked by Polish potato farmers for a couple of days, but that's a whole other story.
I don't know. I've never heard anybody getting hijacked by Polish potato farmers before.
Well, just to finish up Berlin, we were interviewing people as they came through the Brandenburg Gate, and this well-dressed middle-aged couple came through and said, "Well, is this your first time to the West?" "Yes." "What do you want to see?" And they said, "Oh, Der Farber, the colors." And Bob looked at me, he said, "Colors?" I said, "That's what they said, colors." And the next day when we took off for Prague, we realized what it was all about. The East German side was shades of gray. There was no, there were no colors.
No colors.
No colors. And their infrastructure really had not been improved since the war. Buildings were crumbling, the roads were potholes, and that turned out to be a, kind of a wake-up for the West Germans, because they ended up having to pay for all the rebuilding of it. But yeah, incredible, incredible.
Yeah, it is. That is incredible that you were there for that.
Along with Bob Hardy, we went to Saudi Arabia and did a broadcast. And I've got to tell you, we were out in the desert, and it was more comfortable than it is right outside these studios today.
Really?
Oh, yeah. About the same temperature, but absolutely no humidity.
So why did you go to Saudi Arabia? What was going on? What was the...
This is about 2 weeks before Desert Storm went hot.
Oh.
And Bob was close friends... Well, he was retired Air Force and was close friends with the general over at Scott Air Force Base. They played golf together each week. So they arranged for us to go and do a live broadcast, and we did. As we got off the plane and just, boom, out into the desert and came across a unit, and it turned out that as we pulled up, this young kid came running out and he goes, "Are you Kevin McCarthy?" And I'm going like, okay, what's the setup, you know? I'll bite. He said, "No, Mom emailed me and said you were coming over." And he said, "2 weeks ago, I won $1,000 from you on KHTR. You can just see Bob Hardy go,
dang.
But we did a live broadcast there. And I don't know if you remember all of the video that came out of Saudi Arabia for the various networks. You saw two blue domes in the background, large domes. And everybody thought they were radar domes. They were actually the awnings over the swimming pool cabanas for the hotel, where what they call the JIB, the Joint Information Bureau, was.
Uh-huh.
And we sat on the rooftop of the kitchen. And to do the morning show here in St. Louis area, it was basically about midnight. And we're getting set up. There's a 12-man tent with all the satellite uplink and people operating it. And little guy running around, putting up chairs. He goes, "You want the tree?" A little plastic palm tree. And I go, "No, it's radio. That's okay." "Yeah, you want the tree?" I go, "Yeah, sure. Put it right there. That's perfect." And we started off the broadcast. And we had a couple of soldiers and airmen there from the St. Louis area. They'd arranged for that. And our PAO, or political affairs officer, was Mark Rosenkerr. He later went on to become the head of NHTSA, the Transportation Safety Group.
I see.
Marvelous individual. But with the name Rosenkerr, he was not Irish.
Yes.
Okay. About the second or third caller was this older gentleman from University City. And he goes, "Hello, Bob. You got a Mark Rosenkerr with you there?" He goes, "Sitting next to me, that's my nephew." And Mark goes, "Yeah, I do have an uncle in St. Louis. Hi, Uncle Hiram," or whatever, you know. He goes, "That's right." He said, "I got one question for you. Are you going to Temple or not?" It's the first time I've ever seen a colonel's eyes cross. And the guys in the uplink tent are just rolling on the floor. And he said, "Did anybody hear that?" "No, it's okay." Because he was in Saudi Arabia at that time, you know, an Islamic country, and he was very much Jewish. But we later sat with him. We were invited to his pinning party. He made full bird colonel at Scott Air Force Base, and they played that clip, which brought the house down.
That is funny.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And the other international thing, I guess, a couple of them was after the wall came down, I went back with CBS, KMOX, and Voice of America to plant a tree from George Washington's Revolutionary Headquarters on the Russian White House lawn with their vice president, Rutskoy.
Very nice.
And this was at the, what we call a May Day parade, and they call it a victory parade they have every year. And this, the theme of this one was a salute to all veterans of the 20th century. So there were veterans from every country there, including Medal of Honor winners from America, et cetera. And we laid a tomb with the wreath of their unknown soldier, planted the tree on the White House lawn, marched through Moscow for a couple of miles carrying the American flag, which I never got the feeling, and I've been there, I think, four times now, that the Russians ever thought we were going to blow them all to hell in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
We were their allies in World War II.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah,
and we had veterans come out and want to just carry the flag for a few feet. And there
Russian
were
veterans.
Yeah. And there were a couple of Russian teenagers with the new red, white, and blue of Russia. And I motioned to them, "Come on, come on." So they marched along with us. And we traded flags at the end of the deal. But I've got video on our YouTube of the U.S. Air Force Band marching into Red Square playing the Stars and Stripes Forever March.
Wow.
Which still sends chills down my back.
Hey, we're going to end this episode on that note.
Okay.
And we're going to come back next episode. And we're going to talk a little bit about your insight with Russia and America and the relationship.
Sure.
Okay. Thanks for coming in. And we'll see you next time.
My pleasure. Thanks, Chris.